Hello and welcome to the podcast of MoralApologetics.com. This is the episode for February 1st, 2015, and I'm your host, Jonathan Pruitt. As always, at MoralApologetics.com, our aim is to get you thinking about the moral argument because we think it has the ability to both illuminate the mind and stir the heart. In this week's episode, we hear from Dr. Brian Scalise. Dr. Scalise is going to introduce himself here in just a minute, but his dissertation involved, according to Dr. Scalise, analyzing Trinitarian monotheism vis-a-vis unitary monotheism, and this comparison looked specifically at Islam, Trinity, and human relationships. And that's kind of a technical way of talking about the implications for the theology of Allah versus the theology of Yahweh in Christianity and Islam. And specifically on this week's episode, we're going to discuss the implications for love in both Christianity and Islam. And we're going to look at what follows from each religion's view of God. What does Allah's absolute oneness mean for love? And what does the Christian Trinity tell us about love? The idea is that what we think about God as the ultimate reality ought to shape what we think about love. And we're going to spell that out this week. But with all that in mind, we're going to head over to Dr. Scalise's house here in Lynchburg and hear what he has to say. Hope you enjoy the conversation. Okay, Dr. Scalise, can you just tell, before we get going here, can you just tell us a little bit about yourself?
I did my dissertation on comparative religion, Christianity, and Islam in terms of Trinity and Allah. Presently, I work at Liberty University. I teach Greek, theology, and apologetics, and sometimes an occasional other course.
Okay, cool. So, and what was your subject of dissertation?
I looked real extensively at what we can know about God from our human relationships, because sometimes we take these as just a granted and we don't really look at them real closely because it's just so everyday to us. However, God speaks in Genesis 1:26 through 28 and Genesis 2:24 about how humanity and man and woman represent this image of himself, and therefore we have perfect biblical and scriptural grounds for an investigation of what we can know about God through our human relationships.
Okay. Well, so one of the questions I wanted to ask you as we get going and exploring some of this in your dissertation is, what is love and how does that relate to our knowledge of God?
Yeah, it's probably the biggest issue is here, and this is one that we can't emphasize enough, is the fact that love is something that we do all know by intuition. I think that we kind of have this immediate knowledge of it, and maybe we can't quite articulate it. But and then we have our experiences that go with us that help us modify and understand those things. And probably more importantly, especially for the dissertation in this topic, though, is the fact that if you're a theist, depending on this conversation, Christianity or Islam, your idea of love is going to be modified in the way that you understand God, especially in the Christian tradition, because Christians obviously all say God is love. And we'll come to see later that also Islam is going to make a similar claim, not quite God is love, but almost God is all merciful or all compassionate. So it still has kind of these loving overtones, but it's not quite the same thing as what Christianity affirms. And this is going to modify our understanding of love. So simply put, I think love is truly relationality.
Okay. But so it would be a certain kind of relationality, though, right?
Yeah, it would be one that is favorable. So we're in it for the other in the sense that we're with them and we're for them. So I think all three of those are really important dimensions of love because you need to be in it. So whatever that person's good, whatever is for their good, you're in it for that. But you're also with them. So I think sometimes we feel that lack of love. I know I can think I've had a lot of young people talk to me about their fathers. Like, yeah, their dad's in it for them, for their good, and they know that, but he's not really with them. He doesn't take the time to be with them. They feel that, you know, and we all intuitively know that's not love. Like, you need to be in it for me and with me. Yeah. You need to be for me and with me. Both need to be there.
So it's not just about intention, it's about affection too, right?
Mm-hmm. And action on my behalf.
Right.
You know, if you love me, then you're going to act in such a way for my good. It's not enough just to have a feeling or an intention to do me good.
Yeah, you know, and I think as Christians, we often overcorrect. Because in the popular culture, love is reduced to mere affection, right?
Certainly.
And then in the church, we often hear that, well, love is just a choice to consider someone, consider someone's interests at your own expense or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
But it's actually both. It's both affection and a decision to act for a person, right?
Yeah, I would definitely affirm that. I mean, it's about intimacy, being with people, and it's about acting on their behalf, so being for them. But I think right. you need both to have the full piece of the puzzle.
So, now, I know in your dissertation you talk a lot about the difference between the Muslim vision for love and the connection to God, or Allah, and the Christian understanding of love and this relationship to God. So maybe you could start off by just telling us a little bit about the nature of God in Christianity and Islam, and maybe some of the differences.
Yeah, I'd be glad to do that. So just for the remainder of this conversation, let's make a real clear terminological decision and just say, we're talking about the God of Islam, we'll call him Allah.
Okay.
And when we speak about the God of Christianity, we'll just say God. We might say God, the Trinity, or something along right. those lines. But that way we have a real clear articulation about who we're speaking. So love is going to be understood based on however you understand God or Allah, depending on which religion you're looking at. Mm-hmm. Now you might say, well, why is this? Well, it's because God or Allah is before all things. So there's a sense in which he is the most pristine or primordial or original form of a being. So if you're looking for a cosmological or pre-creation basis for love, this is the only recourse you have. There's nowhere else to look. So yeah, we can trust our intuitions about love, but as theists, we're also going to have to ask the question of, well, what can we know about love from who God was, so to speak, or who Allah was before creation? And as we're going to see, there's great differences here between the Trinity and Allah. So let's just kind of go through three categories, and we'll compare and contrast God and Allah.
Right. So I just wanted to stop for 1 second. You emphasized the before creation. And what would be the importance of talking about God prior to creation?
Yeah, most of this has to do with the fact that almost all Muslims and all Christians are going to say that God cannot be dependent on creation. Mm-hmm. So if God's dependent on creation, then there becomes a sense in which he's really not worthy to be worshipped, maybe, or you can say that it's almost the logical conundrum. Well, God is dependent on creation, but yet there was a time which creation didn't exist. Mm-hmm. So you run into some really big philosophical problems there. And but just say, I know Muslims are going to say it's blasphemous to say that Allah is dependent on creation. As Christians, I think we're going to say the same thing. So we have to look and say, what was God's love like, or what was Allah's love like before creation? Because whatever this love is, it can't be tied to creation, or otherwise, if God only loves with the coming of creation, well, then he's dependent on it for right. essential feature that we attribute to him.
Right. So is the idea that God sans creation is complete, and still we would still say maximally great, for example, and meaning that if we take love to be a virtue or an excellence, then God must have this attribute necessarily. And that would be without creation.
Mm-hmm.
Right?
Correct.
Okay.
Correct. Yeah, I think that's right on the money, because he's got to, as you say, if it's one of his attributes,
yeah.
meaning it's not something that'd be separate from him, then it has to be able to stand on its own.
Right. Okay. So let's talk about that a bit more.
All right. So if you take a look at, let's just talk about oneness. Now, oneness in Islam, when they speak about Allah's oneness, they use a term called Tawheed. And this term is really designed to accentuate Allah's uniqueness, but also his unity. Now, whenever we see this term, though, we kind of turn to look at the Trinity, we see that Christians use the idea of oneness in a similar way, but there's going to be some major differences here. So let's start with Allah. Tawheed. Tawheed means that there's basically, even using the word unity, when you use the word Tawheed, might not be quite accurate. You might want to say simplicity, because really the word unity implies the uniting of more than one thing.
Right,
yeah. Typically, when we hear that word, we think of more than one thing. Now, Muslims would be really uncomfortable with that. No, he's pure simplicity. There's no differentiation in him. There's no difference. There's nothing different from him. And so when you're thinking about Allah, especially before creation, there is nothing for him to be different from. So his oneness, he's just utterly unique and alone and total simplicity. This whole idea of, to be honest, the whole idea of difference or others or anything like that, you can't make any sense of it, because difference doesn't exist before creation. This whole idea of like, you're different from me, or the couch is different from me. Well, you're just one, you're Allah, you're the one, and you're alone, and there's no difference in you, and there's no difference outside of you. Whence comes difference?
Right.
Where does that come from? All right, so then so let's transition now. So then we take a look at the Trinity, but probably the most famous theologian today that really has done some great stuff with this, John Zizioulas. He's a Greek Orthodox theologian, but he really gives what he calls an ontological grounding for otherness. I think a little bit better than most Western theologians, because the Greek Orthodox tend to focus on the persons in the Trinity more than the Western ones. But so when we say God is one, Christians, what do we mean? That the Father, the Son, and the Spirit have one and the same nature. But already, though, when we list those three persons, the Father, the Son, and the Spirit, this doesn't entail tritheism, because we believe they have one and the same nature, but there's some sort of internal distinctions represented in that unity. Mm-hmm. And so we feel comfortable to say, now, some people don't like the word, I don't think you should use the word separate, and I'm a little bit nervous about using the word differentiation, but I like the word of internal distinctions. Mm-hmm. I think that's a really helpful term to kind of really illustrate this. But so the Muslim says tawhid, unique simplicity, there's no difference whatsoever. Christianity says God's homoousia, or ousia, his oneness. And what we mean by that is that there's these intra relationships and Father, Son, and Spirit by virtue of this one and the same nature. So our starting points are vastly different here.
Okay. I wonder what you would say about the formulation, three persons and one substance.
Yeah, I think that's excellent. The one substance, mia ousia in Greek, and this term reflects the fact that we don't think whatever is proper to divinity, mm-hmm. so a maximal set of great-making properties, so to speak. So all knowledge, all power, aseity. And we could keep going.
Right.
Okay, so whatever is proper to divinity entails in all three of the persons, because they're the same nature, the right. same ousia. Same. And then with the three persons, though, and historically, and I'm going to go back to John of Damascus, because he's probably the most famous for really making clear, but he would say something like this. John of Damascus would say that the persons represent their properties, the individual, the distinct persons, properties, what makes one the Father, what makes one the Spirit, and what makes one the Son. This doesn't have to do, though, with what they are, but how they express themselves. So this is more like, and this is just an analogy, so let's be careful with this, but this is more like personality and less about the whatness of something. Mm-hmm. So, and by the way, I think one of the best theologians on it, Maximus the Confessor, was a few centuries before John Damascus, and this guy, I mean, he really lays out, and he uses two Greek terms, I think it's, but he says tropos refers to the persons, that is how they are, mm-hmm. and then ousia refers to the what they are. And so the whatness, though, isn't more foundational. The how they are and what they are equally foundational, just like me as a person. I'm what I am, but I'm also who I am. So I think the, you know, one nature would be more like the what, and who I am would be more like the person. But there's no such thing as a human nature that's not also a person.
Right.
And so we would speak similarly of the Trinity.
Okay, so let's. I think now we're in a good spot to maybe cash out the complications for our notion of love, contingent on these ideas about who God is, right?
Right. So the biggest thing, and to be real simple about it, love in Christianity has to be inherently relational, whereas love in Islam has to be inherently lonely. If we're going to say that love is something that is an attribute of God before he creates, or Allah, then we have to look at him. We see God, the Trinity, relational. And then we see Allah, alone, not relational. So I argue in my dissertation that the Trinity makes much better sense of our intuition mm-hmm. and our human experience, because I think it's almost an absurdity to say, well, I'm alone, but yet I experience love. I think most people intuitionally are just going to say, well, I experience love when I'm with others. Whereas if I'm not with others, there's no opportunity right. even to experience love, unless you want to say something along the lines of, you know, some sort of narcissism or self-love or what have you. But most people are going to recognize that that's probably a illness, not a healthy
illness. Well, yeah, you know, so here's the thought. One is to say that, well, you can't have love alone, which, you know, even Jesus says, love your neighbor as you love yourself, right? That there is an appropriate way to love yourself, and that maybe Allah could exhibit love towards himself, right?
What do you think? Sure, yeah. I wouldn't deny that. I would think that's right on the money. Right. I certainly think that we can all love ourselves. The question is, does that become diminished from a larger richness mm-hmm. that is proper to the idea of love? Okay. So if you look at Trinitarian theism, you're certainly going to say yes, because we believe God's Trinity, therefore, this whole idea of ever being alone is something that's anathema. So, on the other hand, though, Allah loving himself, I think that's a proper thing, and I would think each of us individually should, you know how to do that, and that's something that we should engage in.
Right. So the idea is then that, not that Allah would necessarily be completely devoid of love prior to creation, because he could have self-love.
Yes.
But that if we think that qualitatively there's something better about loving others, that Allah is not going to be able to do that. That's going to be a problem for Islam.
Yeah, that would be the conclusion, because there's just no way to get any otherness in him. Because in Islam, you have this idea of shirk. Mm-hmm. So if you associate something with Allah, especially before creation, well, that's shirk. That's the most heinous sin. But because they believe in Tawheed, he's utterly simple, there's no way to get any sort of internal distinctions inside of right, Allah. Right. So you basically end up with, there's no way to have any otherness in here. So there's no way for his love to ever center on and be used on another. It's just on himself. So he could certainly be loving. It's just the fact that what love is on that definition becomes this kind of self-focused thing. Mm-hmm. And that's where the problem, I think, is going to work itself out.
Okay.
Let me illustrate this a bit further, because I think St. Augustine, in my dissertation, it's actually fascinating, because there's a Muslim thinker, his name is Al-Dalami. And Al-Dalami actually uses St. Augustine's Trinitarian formula. So St. Augustine, in his most famous, maybe one of the most famous works on the Trinity, De Trinitate, comes up with the former lover, beloved, and love for the Father, the Son, and the Spirit. Al-Dalami uses that in his own articulation of Allah. And in my dissertation, I put these side by side and I compare them.
Yeah.
And what you find out is that, okay, well, the Father's actually executes some action on another person, namely the Son, who is beloved. And the execution of that action, this loving, this being in it and with him, is the Spirit. The Spirit takes on a personal identity that actually, it's not just some ambiguous, you know, emotion. It actually is this personal entity that's sharing in that. So you have these three persons. And then you take it, though, and, you know, these Muslim thinkers, they're not ashamed of this either. This isn't something that they're embarrassed about. Effectively, Allah is the lover, and he is the beloved, and the center of his loving activity is himself. So you have this, what I call a cyclone of self-centeredness. And that, I'm not trying to go after it too hard. It's just that that's what it is. And the Muslim thinkers don't shy. The most famous Muslim thinkers in my dissertation, Al-Khazali, and then Ibn Taymiyyah, Ibn Arabi, these three guys are some of the most representative Muslim thinkers you can find mm-hmm. in all of their history. And so I go and I look at their stuff, and I'm not embarrassed, and they would affirm this.
That Allah is self-focused.
That is self-focused. Right. And to be honest, I think there's, in the in-house Christian conversation, you see a similar thing. Well, basically God loves himself through us would be the idea in Islam. Mm-hmm. And I think some people in Christianity would say something similar to that.
Yeah. I think about, I think that gets expressed when you say something like, we exist for God's glory, and then it's kind of simplified into, the only reason you exist is to glorify God, right? Which would mean that God created us just to, for the sole reason of loving himself or some, or having creatures like tell him how great he is. You know, it can kind of get this sort of superficial tone to it, I think, right?
Yeah, I think the probably the major move that happens there when you do that,
yeah,
you say, well, we exist for God's glory, is I think there's a sense where I become a means to another end,
right,
rather than being an end to myself. And I think that's a, based on, if you believe that God is Trinity, I think that's a severe error. Because if God is love, okay, and how we're defined, the Father loves the Son loves the Spirit, Spirit loves the Father, so forth.
Right.
If you believe that, then love actually, in its most perfected form, it would be within God, and it would be in this kind of outpouring type of love, like Romans 5, 3 says, the love of God is poured out. It's this outpouring love towards others, all right, so that love isn't, well, I use someone to means to love myself, but actually love is perfected when it is being given out for another and to another, in which case you can justify that, like Jesus said in Matthew 25, like whoever did it to the least of these did it to me. This idea that if you love others well as an end in themselves, mm-hmm, you actually, that is pure love. That is glorifying God. It's not that that's a means to glorifying God. Right. That action itself is the glorifying.
So the idea is that, yeah, we do exist for God's glory, but we also exist to be the recipient of God's love, right? So we're an end in ourselves,
mm-hmm,
not just a means to an end for God. We're an end in ourselves in the sense that because we're made in God's image, it's worthwhile for God to love us.
Certainly, yeah. And it's worthwhile for us to mimic how God does that.
Right.
So we should love others as ends in themselves, as glorifying God. It's not that I do that to glorify God as though it's a separate thing. The loving itself is the glory.
So I'm curious, what do the Muslim scholars say then about how they articulate actually the definition of love?
Yeah, they actually, okay, Ibn Taymiyyah. Now, yeah, let me just give you a little history on Ibn Taymiyyah. Ibn Taymiyyah is known as kind of the pre-founder. He lived in the 11th, 12th century, 12th century AD. And he's kind of the founder of Wahhabism and the radical, not radical Islam, the conservative Islamic movement. So actually, Islam today is very conservative. What we're doing right now, they might not even be allowed to do, most of them. It's called innovation or speculation, and they're not even allowed to kind of develop that thinking. So he's the founder of this. So it's kind of ironic that he does quite a bit of innovation himself in these conversations. But so he's hugely influenced in the world of Sunni Islam, especially. And he's going to say that Allah truly loves creatures, but always as a subordinate means to loving himself. So that human creatures become channels or conduits by which Allah loves himself.
Mm-hmm.
And reason why, and the very thing we talked about earlier, the reason why Ibn Taymiyyah argues for this is because he doesn't want to make Allah dependent on creation for something essential to him. Because he does believe that this idea of love or compassion or mercy is something essential to Allah. So you can't make that come about with creation. So, well, basically Allah still loving himself by loving creatures, but that's really this big circular motion or cyclone to get back to loving himself.
Okay. So I'm just trying to think about, so if you just ask, so if you're a Muslim in the context of human relationships, then when they say, I love you, maybe we can do that for both Christians and Muslims. We can say, what would it mean to say, I love you to another person on Christianity and on Islam?
Yeah, and I think, well, it depends on who we are. Are we talking popular crowd? Because, I mean, I don't think that they're even, I mean, is this going to be on the radar?
Yeah, well, let's talk about it in reference to what we just talked about with the notion of love as it relates to our theology of who God is, right?
Yeah, okay. Okay, so if I'm a Muslim and I say I love you, it would always be as a subordinate means to love Allah.
Mm-hmm.
So you would never, so you could not be a mean to, or you can be an end in yourself by saying, I love you. You can't be an end in yourself because ultimately all love is rightly directed to Allah, because all love comes from him and should go back to him. So you become part of that. Now, let's recognize that's dignifying. Like, you become part of that exaltation of Allah, right? So, I mean, I think you could see how the religious believer, I don't think this would sit ill with us. I think we would be comfortable. And I think a lot of Christians think that way as well.
Mm-hmm.
They love others because they think that's a, you know, a means, a separate thing to loving God. Now, on the other side of that, if you believe God is Trinity and you've kind of had this theology worked out in your mind, and I say, I love you, I would say that it would be I'm in it and with you because of you as an end in yourself. And I'm not going to feel any compunction to separate that from the love I'm sending towards God.
Right.
It would be that that action is the one love I'm sending towards God.
Okay.
Jesus at one point says, you know, if you have something against your brother has something against you, leave your gift at the altar and go and make right with him. And I would like to read into that text maybe a little too unfairly, but that might have something to do with what we're discussing here, the fact that making right with your brother, that action of love, is really loving God.
Okay.
As well.
Yeah, so I'm wondering then, it seems like the Muslim view seems to diminish a person's agency, if you're just a means to an end, and another way you could talk about that would be, I am a cog in a machine, right?
Yep.
That I'm just part of a system. I have no agency or autonomy or any kind of freedom in that, right?
Have you read any of these Muslim scholars?
No.
I'm just curious, because actually your question almost, are you leading me to speak about what they conclude?
No.
So it's fascinating, because both Al-Khazali, and again, Al-Khazali, and I might not be pronouncing it, it's a G-H, but Khazali is how it's pronounced. But he is considered the Muslim theologian of all time.
Right.
I mean, nobody, even Miroslav Volf, in his book he wrote recently called Allah, a Christian Response, he names the same guy, and he wrote more than anyone, and just super famous. But both Al-Khazali, Ibn Taymiyyah, the two guys we've already mentioned, and Ibn Arabi, who's the third thinker I looked really closely at, they all end up concluding, Ibn Arabi concluded that the world was pantheistic, mm-hmm. and Ibn Taymiyyah and Al-Khazali both thought that everything really was Allah, that everything's either an illusion, or that's more Al-Khazali, and then you have Ibn Taymiyyah. It's almost like this emanational idea,
mm-hmm.
like this Neoplatonic idea that everything is God. Maybe panentheism might be a good example. But yeah, so it's fascinating that your intuition that, well, you become a means to an end. Well, it's almost like you just become part of something larger.
Yeah. Yeah, and that's, I think that maybe they're motivated to do that, make that move, because of the conflict with what we take love to be. You know, love seems to be about another person, right? And
I'll kind of pick up here. Yeah. Love does always seem to be about another person, but if you believe, and these are all great theologians, that the purest form of love is love of self,
right.
Well, you recognize that as a creature, probably, that I can't do that because all of my love is supposed to owe to God.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of this, well, I must be part of that then, rather than something other. And actually, the Sufi line, which are like the mystics, some of them would go so far as to say they were Allah. They would say this, and they've been killed for it.
Mm.
But they would go that far, you know.
Yeah. So I see what you're saying. The idea is that if the creature isn't really an end in themselves, then but you're supposed to love them, right? Then the creature must be somehow a part of God or something. Like, you have to kind of make this tight connection with God himself if you're going to actually love the creature. But there's no otherness to love, you know?
When you're hitting on an interesting conflict in Islam itself, because you got the Quran that's telling you, yeah, love other people. It does tell you those type of things. But then you have who Allah is, this idea of this one God with no differentiation. There's no otherness. This doesn't exist. Then you end up with this really tough, okay, well, I'm being told to love others, but given the fact that all love initially was for God, from Allah, and then back to Allah, it's this kind of cyclone, this return thing, it's self-centered love, then all of them must get pulled into that cyclone. And that's why I use that language of cyclone.
Yeah.
I think it is cyclonic.
Yeah, that's fascinating. I never thought about that.
Let me drop in a philosophical difficulty here for Islam as well. So a little bit to the side, but we mentioned earlier that there's no way Allah could have any difference in him.
Right.
And there's no way there could be difference outside of him because nothing else existed. It was just him alone. The other issue why the Sufis especially don't want to say that They want to say that they are Allah, mainly some sort of emanational type thing or illusion, is because they recognize, and I think rightly, that if you say that you are other, well, you're calling God other. So you're calling him someone else.
Yeah.
But if he's someone else, now I'm attributing a predicate to him that can only be true of creatures. So you get into this real huge problem where, well, the only way that there's this whole idea of one and another, mm-hmm. that only comes about when Allah creates. And now we're going to call him another? So now all of a sudden you're taking something that's totally a creaturely derived yeah. idea and applying it to him. That's very problematic for Islam.
Wow, interesting.
Well, most of us don't think of otherness as a predicate. You know, right. that just seems like a given, but there's no reason why it has to be a given. In this world, it's yeah. a given. It doesn't have to be that way.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, there is... So, let me just see if I'm tracking with you here. At least... See, this is, it brings up the... Yes, the, so... I'm trying to think about... You just gave me, like, five ideas. So, I'm thinking, if you tried to say that Allah is maximally great, right, then you would... Which may be impossible anyway, but let's just set that aside for a second and say that this unitary being is maximally great, and it follows that he exists in all possible worlds, and there are some worlds in which the only thing that exists is Allah, right?
Correct.
And then in those worlds, there is no other, so the predicate... you know, if you said something like Brian is other, that predicate never is made true by
correct.
Anything.
Never actualized.
So the only worlds in which there is an other is in the worlds which have creatures in them.
Correct.
And then, then you would be assigning to God this contingent category, otherness.
Correct.
Which would be inappropriate.
Yeah, which could be either. One of the two, anthropomorphizing God inappropriately, which right. Islam is strongly against, much more than Christians are, or straight up idolatry.
Right. Now, in the Christian view, since there is otherness central to God in all possible worlds, is the predicate other exists in the sense that there are other persons in the Trinity.
Yeah, and so we have to do some serious work here, we can run down the road of going through how all the theories of predication if you want, right. but
no, yeah.
Yeah, let's just keep it simple.
Right.
Basically, so we have to do a little bit of work, but not nearly as much, because we say, okay, well, within the Godhead itself, then God itself, there's these intra-relationships.
Right.
That are truly, there's these persons that are other, but they're not separate. Right. So the only difference we have to make when we come to human creatures is we say, there's true others, but now they're also separate. Does that make sense? Yeah. So you're not me and I'm not you. We're not one in the same nature right. like the Trinity is. So it's not a big step to make. So I think probably the cleanest way to say this technical language is, creaturely reality is an analogical representation of the otherness in the Trinity.
Okay. Yeah, well, that's a fascinating argument there. Yeah, that's really cool.
Well, I tell you what, I got a lot of this stuff from the Greek fathers because in the West, we tend to focus on God's unity to such a degree that we don't ever... Basically what happens, and it's incorrect, if you take the formula, one nature, three persons, you're supposed to hold those with equal proportionality. Right. You can't maximize one more than the other. You got to hold them equal. So if you... In the West, though, what tends to happen is that we don't. We tend to focus on the oneness, and so personhood or the distinctions becomes diminished. And so we don't ever think through what are the consequences of the equally ontological reality of persons with that ontological reality of nature.
Right.
You know, you don't think through that. You think that you just kind of say, well, this is the ontological priority, the nature, and the persons are just kind of the side thing we throw in there.
Yeah, I think most Christians, probably the West, are actually modalists.
Probably.
Well, let's wrap this section up here and come back around to maybe a conclusion on this, and just say, can you just tell us briefly why the difference between love on Islam and Christianity, and why love might be a problem on Islam?
Yeah, based on our human intuitions and experiences, most of us are going to say that the notion of loving myself is incomplete without also the ability and experience of loving others.
Right.
And I would also point out that you can't escape that reality. When you're born as a result of sex or love, however you want to say that, and you're born into a world of community. That's inescapable. That's your reality from day one of conception. So look at this, and Allah says, well, the view of Allah says, well, love is this lonely thing. It's alone. It's about self-love. And again, we want to be charitable to our most. So I try to stay away from narcissism because I don't think you necessarily have to conclude that. That's kind of putting some sort of, you know, mental illness on your view of God.
Right.
I try to stay away from that. But there, it's self-love. And then on the Trinity's view, you always have this essential focus of the love on others.
Right.
That's always there. And that meets our human reality to far greater degrees and the scope of our human experience than can this notion of self-love alone. And I would point out, lastly, in conclusion, no one's ever experienced loving yourself alone. No one's ever experienced that. Yeah, you can say, well, I've done it by myself, but you're always in a context of others.
Right.
Always.
But you know, yeah, I think about, you know, even Jesus' statement, love your neighbor as you love yourself, that there's this, even in that statement, there's this connection above loving yourself and loving others that wouldn't really make any sense to love yourself without that love for others.
Yeah, and maybe next session we can return to that, because I think there's some area to probe there.
Okay. All right. Well, thank you for that insightful discussion, Dr. Scalise.
Well,
and thanks again to Dr. Brian Scalise for that very thoughtful discussion. I hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I certainly learned quite a bit from Brian in our short time together. I just want to remind you, like I always do, that moralapologetics.com has new content going up several times a week from a wide range of sources. Biblical scholars, theologians, philosophers, poets, literary scholars, just a whole host of content from a wide array of thinkers. And I'm sure you can find something there that will be beneficial to you. And if you haven't liked us on Facebook, you can do that. Or you can follow us on Twitter to make sure you get the absolute up-to-date content from moralapologetics.com. And I'm glad you stopped by, and I hope to see you here again next week.